Hello, everyone. Here I am about to make a bad joke to cheer up the audience. It is 10 p.m. Everyone would rather be asleep than listen to talk about vacuum deposition systems, yet here we are.
Yes.
Hello, everyone. You're a wonderful audience. It's good to see you all again. Leah, would you introduce yourself?
Yeah. Hello. I'm a co-founder of FAFO, one of the, 10 people, maybe, that founded FAFO. And you may know me from other projects. I'm a maintainer of Void Linux. I wrote the Ruby Rack library that you probably use if you host some Ruby software. I'm mostly known for posting Unfug on Feli, which is like silly jokes. I also wrote a bunch of Unix tools. I have a contribution to the Linux kernel, which is one negative line of code. I think that makes me unique, probably. And yeah, I also invented a tumble lock, if you still remember what that is. And I was involved in cracking Ken Thompson's Unix password, but that's also another story. And this is Q3K.
Yes, this is me again. Hello, I'm Q3K. You might know me from many other weird random things on the internet, including doing some train stuff earlier on this decade. It feels like it's been a decade. And if you've been on Fediverse and saw random posts about electron microscopes, there's a big chance it was written or at least co-authored by me. That being said, I think we prepared 93 slides for you today, and we're already 1 minute in, so let's go. Leah, go ahead.
Okay, so what is FAFO? FAFO is a Verein that we founded roughly 2 years ago, and FAFO stands for Fachverein für Forschung. At least that's what we tell the tax office. Maybe you can figure out what the acronym actually means. And the goal of FAFO is to have a lab which enables us to create semiconductors, but we also started to work on many related technologies. We are hosted in Munich, and it's a private group of a dozen of people nowadays. And you can imagine it a bit like a hackspace, but with less social drama and more actually technology, working on technology. In the background of this slide, you see our tech tree, which works like a tech tree in some computer game. So if we want to do a technique X, we have some dependencies, and first we need to learn how to do Y and Z. And so in the background, you see the green nodes that we know how to do already, and we have other nodes where we are working on, or the red nodes, which we want to do at some point, but we cannot do yet. So quick disclaimer for this talk. We are not scientists, we are computer nerds, so we actually noticed we have no qualified physicist in our team. We have a bunch of people who know stuff in other areas, but yes, we want to talk about stuff that we did and the things that we learned, and so it's not a lecture where you learn everything about vacuum deposition, but just the things that we found interesting and the things you need to know to understand this talk. It's also not a safety training, so please be careful if you try to do anything of this at home.
We are not saying you shouldn't be doing these things at home, but if you do and when you do, just read up. Don't trust random people from the internet.
You have to learn that for yourself and check the things. So we will talk about creation of synth films. Why are synth films interesting as a technology? So since the goal of FAFO is to make a microchip at some point and integrated circuits, many of the structures we need for those things can be created using synth film technology. So on the right of the picture, you see some decapped chip, an older chip, I think. And it's taken with our own scanning electron microscope. And you see the structures, they're these patterns. And these patterns are created layer by layer by creating them on some silicon wafer, for example. And so we can make conducting traces, isolating traces, and we also can make the basic electronic devices like resistors and capacitors. And most importantly, we can make transistors, which enable us to do logic on the circuits. But synth film technology is a very large area, and it's useful for many other things that we probably won't do in the near time, but maybe you are interested in them, so you are interested in this talk as well. So you can do sensors, photosensors, for example. You can create solar cells. And if you ever saw a lens, it probably has some anti-reflexive covering, which is created using thin film technology. And same for mirrors. And lastly, also, it's sometimes used to make things look shiny, which is just like for creating beautiful things. Or taking cheap things and make them look more expensive, maybe. So to make thin films, you need a very controlled way of deposition. And so in the literature, we found four basic ways of different depositions. So the very easiest thing are chemical deposition, which is non-vapor based. And for example, it's just like you dip the thing into some liquid, and then you pull it up, and then hopefully only on a thin area something happened, a chemical reaction. There's also a thing called spin coating, where you spin and the substrate quickly, then you put a drop of liquid on top, and then you get a very thin layer that spread evenly across the surface. You can do things like plating, electroplating, where you use a voltage to deposit some kind of ions on top of your surface. But today we want to speak about physical vapor deposition, which both means physical. So physical means non-chemical. So this means that neither the substrate nor the things that we want to deposit on it actually change in matter. So it's like, I mean, in chemistry, you have two things and they react together and you get a new kind of material. And here we are interested in just combining things, for example. And there are two big topics, which are thermal evaporation and sputtering, which we will discuss in detail. Then there's also chemical vapor deposition and atomic layer deposition, which are out of our interest scope right now. And the main reason is why we care about physical vapor deposition is that it allows us to create more precise and thinner layers than the like more naive versions. And since it happens in a vacuum, we are not worried about oxidation. It's also a process which is quite safe and quite clean in terms of handling dangerous chemicals or poisonous materials. And so electroplating, it's easy to do in principle, but you end up with lots of poisonous stuff.
Yeah, for example, chrome plating used to be done by electroplating. That stuff creates some really noxious shit, like high oxidation states of chromium, and that's not good for you. So the industry really has moved away, even if PVD is more expensive, into PVD for example,
chrome extraction. So it's both dangerous to work with these things, and it's hard to get rid of the reactants again at some point. Also, it can be automated quite easily. You don't need to do many manual steps, but if you have the right device, you can deposit layers of various material in like one run of the machine. And it's also still fairly affordable to hobbyists compared to like state-of-the-art technologies such as atomic layer deposition. Okay, so how does thermal evaporation work in theory? When people hear about evaporation or vapor, they think about the boiling pot of pasta usually. Like you heat water and the water starts to boil in the pot, and then it, like if you don't have the lid on, it starts filling your kitchen with the water vapor. But if you have this idea of vapor, then it's not intuitive to see what actually happens in thermal evaporation. Because, do you see the cursor on this? No, okay. So we have the aluminum substrate at the bottom of the picture. Sorry, the aluminum material, and we want to deposit it on the sample at the top. And what we now do is that we use, for example, a tungsten boat, where we put the aluminum inside, and then we run a large current through the tungsten, so it gets hot. And the aluminum starts
to do something. It's not exactly clear. Like people say, this sublimates, but I've seen it molten with my own eyes. So I think it depends on the molecular weight, and it's a bit complex for me to
think
about.
So I think what happens on this is now happening in a vacuum. And what happens is that on the surface, the single aluminum atoms get taken apart from the solid structure and they become a gas, essentially. So they are single particles that are now in the floating in the space, but they have like a directional drift depending on how they were ripped off, essentially, by the power of the heat. And so this this is now the unintuitive thing, like in a vacuum, particles move in a straight line in the order of their direction, because in the gas, like if you have a normal atmosphere or something, it would like bounce on the next gas atom it hits, but there are no other particles in the vacuum, so stuff really moves for several meters in a straight line. And exactly, so the aluminum is hot, but the sample is cold. So when the aluminum hits the sample, it cools down, and it actually starts to deposit on the surface. So deposition is when a gas turns into a solid phase again. And yeah, so the angles that aluminum particles can have is kind of randomized, but since the aluminum part is smaller than the sample part, we get a kind of uneven distribution. It's the so-called cosine distribution of angles. So this means that in the middle of the sample, we will get more particles than on the outer sides. But an easy solution is to move the sample, like not rotate it about itself, but like put it into some kind of construction that spins, and then you can quite easily get an even deposition. So a few basic things about working with vacuum. There are many different units of pressure, and it's a bit confusing at first. So the rough ideas you should have is like one bar is roughly the pressure at sea level. And we will mostly work with millibars, which is like a thousandth of a bar. And the SI unit would be one hectopascal. But usually, like European research uses millibar, and Americans use a tor, which is 4/3 millibars or something. But like,
it's the same order of magnitude.
It's like,
when
the
you
same
see
order
a tor
of
and
magnitude.
It's small enough, it's probably good enough to assume it's a millibar,
yeah,
right?
Like, we don't make very precise measurements. We just care about the order of magnitude, more or less. And so millibar will be used in the following. So yeah, so 10^3 millibars are the standard atmosphere that we, that the air has, that we live in usually. And 0 millibar is not possible because there's no perfect vacuum. So we are looking at the negative powers to get like closer to the 0 point. And yeah, so 10^-2 millibar is where like a naively built pump stops working, and 10^-9 is ultra high vacuum, which is more than we need for the processes that we care about. So interesting for us is -2 to -6. And yeah, why do we need a vacuum? I already said it, particles in a vacuum can move freely, and this is called the mean free path. That's like the average distance that a particle can take without being distracted or hitting something else. So lower pressure is good, and at roughly 10^-5 millibars, you get 1 meter of distance, or even a bit more. And so since our machines are not like 1 meter space inside, this is what we need. Okay, so let's talk about the practical details.
Right, so we've gone through the physics by nerds lecture, so again, do not quote us on this, please. But we actually do need a vacuum. How the hell do we get a vacuum? Here's the value we want. We want to reach like 10^-5 millibar. Well, you need a pump. There's multiple pumps. There's so many types of pumps, but the kind of rough idea is at first you just like move the air out mechanically, like you just use what looks like a normal water pump, except like higher precision, higher grade oil filled. You get it out like 10^-2 millibar, and then like you use a second stage pump, which would be a high vacuum pump. And those like actually, in combination with the primary pump or like the rotary pump, get you to the high vacuum regime. Then you can go even further with like even more fancier pumps. Like the more money you have, the lower you can go. We'll kind of be in the regime of like using a rotary vacuum pump plus either an oil diffusion pump or turbomolecular pump, which are two different kinds of high vacuum pumps that are mostly used. Oil diffusion gives you zero moving parts, but you get a fire hazard. Thermomolecular pumps give you no fire hazard, but can implode violently, so pick your poison. Here's a roughing pump that if you see something like that when you're hunting for junk on eBay, like this is going to be a roughing pump. This is a pretty small one, like the filter, the toilet paper filter is bigger than the pump in this case. Usually that's not the case. This is, I think, Ellen's pump. Thank you, Ellen. It is now broken. The pump, not Ellen. There's some backflow, but it served well. Here's an oil diffusion pump next to a thermomolecular pump, so these are the second stage high vacuum stuff. On your left, you will see an oil diffusion pump with the contents inside placed in a plastic bottle for cleaning. The thing inside is what creates magic fucking vortices of oil particles to create a vacuum. Just Google it, it's fun. And on the right, you have a family of two turbos, a small one and a big one. The small one is smaller, yes. If you want to look at other vacuum stuff, you'll more often see these kind of fittings that you know you're kind of in the regime you're looking for as well. These are called KF, Klein flange, I think. ISO KF standard. These are nice because they are still based around O-rings, so it's not like you need weird sacrificial copper gaskets. You just clamp them together and they work, and also they are fairly easy to machine in like a normal kind of setup at a hackerspace even. This is, for example, a Gardena to KF adapter, if you would like one. So yeah, so we have our vacuum chamber. As we said, we're going to need two pumps to actually get to the regime we need. So here are the two pumps. The thermomolecular pump is usually going to be below the chamber. This has been historically because that's where the old diffusion pump was. You need like a good interface, like a big surface area between your high vacuum pump and your chamber, because you need like the ions to actually have a chance of falling into it and getting kind of moved down and getting exhausted. So you have it has to be somewhere in the chamber. Traditionally on the bottom with some turbos, you can mount them on the side, but generally, if you're looking at vacuum chambers, like look underneath them, you'll probably see a big fuck off pump. And then the rotary pump can be somewhere else. Like the shorter the path, the better, but this can be like a few meters of tubing. Cool, we have a vacuum. Let's measure it. We're gonna need some gauges. Again, multiple kinds of gauges. Usually in the kind of shitty machine regime you're going to be looking for, you're going to look for a Pirani gauge, which is a fancy light bulb that will heat up differently based on how much gas there is. And you can use that to basically feedback through like a four-wire measuring setup the resistance of it, which means you can get the vacuum. It's also a very fun little invention. And then you have probably some kind of ion gauge. There's, again, multiple kinds of them, either hot cathode, cold cathode. Cold cathode is a bit nicer because there's a lower chance of you fucking it up if you run it while the vacuum is not rough enough, not high enough. But yeah, those work in a different way. I can't be bothered to explain this right now because I also don't know how they work exactly. I forgot. Cool. You have pumps. You have gauges. You're probably also going to need a valve. This valve exists so that you can like actually cycle stuff in and out of your chamber. It's going to be some kind of sliding valve or maybe like a pop-up valve or something. This is all usually some kind of standard mounting flange, so you can just find something on eBay and make it work. Cool. Then you probably also need a three-wave roughing valve. The idea is that before you expose the chamber to the high vacuum of the turbo pump, you want to first rough it out, and this is kind of like a bypass, so that first you get your turbo down to high vacuum alongside the rotary pump, then whenever you want to bring the chamber down because you're ready to process a sample, you first rough the chamber and then connect it to the turbo. Cool, easy. Feed-throughs, another thing you need. You need to probably power your actual boat for thermal evaporation. Like Leia said, it's a heating device. It's basically you take a big fuck-off piece of tungsten, pass current through it. It's some kind of fairly low voltage, high amperage stuff. You need to feed that through into the vacuum. Cool hackers will just use spark plugs. Other cool hackers will use broken vacuum gauges as a feed-through, or you can just buy a feed-through, or you can even try making one. That's really the basic setup. Like if I was to build a thermoevaporator, this is probably what I'd get started with. A nice thing to have after that is a film thickness monitor, because you want to know how much you've deposited. And a film thickness monitor it just kind of hangs out near the sample, and it gets covered as your sample gets covered, and then you can read back how much it got covered by. How does it work? Magic. It's called a quartz crystal microbalance, and basically, I mean, it's actually not magic, it's actually really fun and intuitive again. You take a quartz crystal, in this case it's gold, quartz gold, and then as you coat it, its resonance frequency is going to increase because you can think of it intuitively as it gets heavier. Like the math is more complicated, like, you know. It's called the Sauerbrey equation. It's a lot of terms, but it all kind of makes sense if you look at it. Cool thing is just buy these things. Like, it's $70 for 10 of them. The internet has you, fam. You put that inside a little thing, you water cool it, and then ta-da, you can also figure out how much you're actually coating your stuff. Is that it? Oh no, wait, we also need something to control the turbo. Turbo is not something you plug into the wall. The wall doesn't just like run on 60 Hertz. This thing needs to spin up like, assuming you have a turbo, not an old, but you probably will. This thing needs to spin at like 50,000 RPM. It needs a fairly fancy controller. Someday I want to try driving it from like a hobby ESC. That hasn't happened yet, but it'd be really funny. And you need some kind of like overall system to control it, or just enough buttons and valves that can control it by itself. All right. There you go. That's a firmware evaporator. You can just build one. And before we get to that, here's a little quiz. What can you tell me about this vacuum chamber? I've given you enough data, impromptu quiz, everyone, to be able to figure out maybe a few things just from this photo. Like, if you look at the fittings, you'll see, OK, this is KF. So this is not ultra-high vacuum. That's something that should immediately jump out to you. Do you see any pump? I don't. I don't see anything at the bottom. We can't really see from this photo, but there's no really also good way to mount any turbo from the top. So I can kind of assume this is not like a high vacuum system even. It's like a rough vacuum system. Do you see some gauges? Yeah, there's some gauges sticking out. So this is indeed a vacuum chamber, not, I don't know, a fucking cooking pot. You can try to infer some more free things, like the more you know kind of what to look for, you know what this has been like. Is there any feed-throughs? Like, are there other feed-throughs like data or high voltage? Is there any access ports? Like, is there a way to cycle a sample? So yeah, what can you tell me about this chamber? Do you know what this is? I have no idea, but here's an Allen for scale. We got this from an auction. It's just fun to buy vacuum stuff. Can recommend. Just have friends where you can store it at their place, because this thing's really fucking big. So yeah, congratulations. You can now build a thermo evaporator. The parts are on ClientSigon and on eBay. There's plenty of people who have done it on YouTube. Have fun. But what if I told you there is another way? You don't have to do the hard thing. You know what else is on ClientSigon? Magical keywords like labor convolute. You can just type in these magical words and then discover you can just buy things. Introducing King Edwards, our first just bought thermo evaporator system. There was more stuff in the slot, hence the big fuck in the previous thing, but we'll get to that later. This is 70s, 80s stack. It has a nice little bell jar enclosure, so you can see what's going on. It has the, not explodey, but fire hazardy kind of pump, an old diffusion pump, and has a cool crown. The crown is to hold the bell jar upside down once you open it. But yeah, how, like, you see this on ClientSigon. You want this in your home. I know you do. How do you get there? Side note, how do you buy old junk? First of all, have a general idea what you want to buy. Like, don't buy things in the dark. At least kind of pretend you know what's going on. Figure out, first of things, is this thing going to kill you? Like, what are the ways it's going to kill you? Because it can kill you. It can crush you, or you can just find noxious stuff inside. Can you run it? Do you, like, how heavy it is? Does it need power, cooling, fucking weird gases? And if it's heavy, and it's probably going to be, because vacuum stuff tends to be heavy, like, can you split it up into parts that make it easier to carry? And generally, look for older shit, because that you have like a chance of actually fixing it. If there's any electronics that are like 90s or newer, that's going to be a whole project in its own. Every single manufacturer is going to tell you to just fuck off. So you'd rather be in a position where you can fix things yourself. And yeah, just do it. Like, it's fun. Gather some friends, go on a road trip, pictured here. Next step, how do you load old junk? When you arrive at the seller's place, first of all, be nice to them. They're selling you something for a good deal, because that's why you're getting it, because you wouldn't get it if it was a bad deal, right? Take photos of everything, wear gloves, like we learned it this hard way. Like, and when you're around semiconductor stuff, you can trust that they didn't work with arsenic, but you should probably still wear gloves, right? If you disconnect any cable, label it first. Really like engage the most fucking walk around the clipboard, right? Like, be as serious as you can. It really matters. You're going to thank yourself later. And also, when they're being nice, like, you know, you can be nice by many ways. You can also, for example, always carry a crate of beer with you and offer them, like, hey, would you like some alcohol-free beer from Bavaria? That's always a nice gift. Then they might give you some stuff back. They might give you some accessories, some dogs. Maybe they'll let you take a loot for the other stuff they have. Because if someone's selling this sort of junk, it's probably not the only junk they're willing to part with. And when they offer you something else, like, haggle. Do not make the mistake of like jumping at an opportunity like I did, where you just like someone tells you 500 euros, you're like, yes, I'll take it. Just haggle a bit, but be nice. Okay, you have loaded your old junk. How do you get it home? Our favorite, has been to just rent a 3.5-ton truck with a ramp. Tramps are nice. You can just like load the stuff, get back in, get a pallet jack, get Euro boxes, get straps, and you know, 3.5 tons truck. You should be able to load it a ton. Like, if you load it more, don't tell anyone. We've never done that, but you know, probably no one's going to notice. for like if you really need to carry a bunch of crap, like pictured here, rent a truck with a guy. It's usually a guy for some reason. And if you're nice to the guy as well, he'll help you load the stuff because you realize that you don't have time to load it otherwise. So again, be nice to people. It helps. There's contenders from other hackerspace. I've seen people arrive with trailers. If you like lifting stuff, sure. I've seen people arrive with sprinters and fucking ramps and just push things on. Like, sure, I can do that as well, but I just like ramps. Oh, okay, you got it home. Welcome back, King. How do you bring this up? Again, this is kind of a generic thing, like any sort of vacuum system, old lab stuff. Check the electricals, like measure them, make sure you're not gonna kill yourself when you power down. Check the water cooling, like this old stuff is gonna leak. So you probably want to replace more than less of the tubing. If it has a roughing temp pump, replace the oil, and then just like try to slowly bring it up, like pull a vacuum, pull a high vacuum, just see what happens, like slowly test everything. It's just like debugging a program. You know how to do this, right? But most important thing, old stuff. If it ain't broken, don't fix it. Like, this is like an old car. These things wear together. Like, the moment you start fixing small things, like one thing is like slightly off, like, eh, I guess I'll fix that. Something else will follow. Like, you'll break something or something that hasn't like worn evenly or something. Just like, do the minimum amount of work. I am a lazy bastard. I recommend being a lazy bastard in this case as well. Pro tips for vacuum. You can just buy replacement gaskets. It's not that bad. Like if you ruin something, it's fine. You can refurbish surfaces as well. Like if you break up a stainless steel surface, you can just, if you see some rust, you can probably fix that. As I said, old water loops, replace them. And what surprised me the most, like valves get stuck. Like you'd think you haven't run it for 10 years, it's probably fine. No, they get stuck. Like you're debugging something, like, why the hell doesn't this working? It might just be the valve. Don't overthink it. Like, these things will break more often than you expect. You can try to go a bit, you know, above and beyond by cleaning the chamber even. It's going to help you a bit later on because it's going to pull a vacuum faster, but, you know, don't overdo it. And it helps to have, like, other vacuum stuff with you. Like, if you have some other system with gauges that can, like, swap parts around and see if it works, it's going to get easier. Like, usually the first system you bring up is probably going to be more difficult than the next ones from what I've heard from people and myself. Do it. Sometimes you're just going to have to hack things together, and that's fun. Picture to your left is just, like, I didn't know that this fits some other connector, so I just used garden hoses. And I used garden hoses because the previous owner did. So it was like the second generation of the same hack, but with new garden hoses. And to the right is like, you know, the usual situation where a screw just really doesn't want to give, so you take out the Dremel and make it. The I wasn't asking sort of solution. You'll spend a lot of time just debugging things. Like if you like debugging electronics, if you like figuring out what the hell did they mean by doing it this way, it's going to spend a lot of time like that. If you like taking things apart, cleaning them, understanding how they work, you're going to be doing a lot of that. It's fun. But mostly it'll be a lot of just sitting around with old manuals, your favorite energy drink, and you'll be convincing your friends to do the dirty work for you. Because you're the one who's taking charge of the project, so you can get someone else to do the mess. Thank you, Rob. And by the way, you see that white box next to Rob with the schmoo in it? That's what I call vacuum pump mayonnaise. This is oil contaminated with water. It's not supposed to look like that. And coming back to the film thickness monitor, crystal microbalance, this is how you can also spend some time. Like you have a piece of broken equipment, it just doesn't work. So you can just replace all the weird stuff from the 80s with a modern piece of equipment and like see, okay, is this part as broken as this one? You can spend as much time as you want just figuring things out, which is great. And to be a bit less generic, coater. You got your coater. This is where we started. You got your coater from Kleinanzeigen. How do you fix this? Well, do the previous. Keep in mind, like, these things will be filthy inside. People will have deposited films of like unknown provenance on them. These films will become airborne when you start cleaning them. Wear gloves, wear a respirator, find a way to not breathe in the dust. Never use compressed air, to blow out a chamber. That's just, do not. Use a vacuum if you have to. And yeah, like at some point you're going to get the thing to heat up and you can put in some aluminium and it's going to evaporate and it's going to coat everything inside the chamber and yeah, that's pretty much it. You can start experimenting with different metals, like we've done a few of them. We've had a lot of luck having a test setup where we take a microscope glass, then we put a few nanometers of chromium on it, or chrome, I never remember which one is which, I'm not a physicist, and then some aluminium, and that like makes you a really nice tough surface that you can take tape and like pull the tape on it and it's not going to come off of it. So you can kind of tell yourself, okay, I'm actually depositing chrome and some aluminium. If you were to just deposit aluminium, it would come off immediately. So you can deposit stuff, and there's supposed to be a video somewhere around here. There it goes. Yeah. It's not showing here, Jesus Christ. Right, so this is the previous machine, and what you see here is molten aluminium. That's why I was talking that I do not believe that the thing just sublimates, because that's not solid aluminium, is it? Like, am I crazy? It's molten, right? Anyway, this was depositing, and you can do that too. But what next? Let me introduce you to the wonders of the liftoff process. This is the fastest way you can get from being able to deposit a coat of anything into doing something interesting. This is actually was used in the industry to do some lithographical processes instead of depositing a layer of material and then etching away what you don't need through a photo mask. You can do it in reverse. You can first coat, this is step number one, you take your substrate. Step number two, you deposit the photo mask. So the layer on number two, the darker gray one, is a photo mask. You can selectively then remove the photo mask, so develop it, so you end up with the regions that you wish to cover metal are not covered with the photo mask, and then you deposit metal on top. This is step four, the thin black line, that's the metal you deposit. And then you dissolve away the mask. What happens is the metal that was on the mask just starts floating away in solution. Everything else stays behind. So this is a fun way to, we're talking about physical vapor deposition. I don't know if any of this is fun. It's fun to me. So you can go from a substrate and a mask of some fashion and then get into like selective patterning. Now, you could do this with photoresist. You could do this with e-beam resist. You could do this with direct write lithography. So many ways to selectively harden a mask. Or you could use a Sharpie. Turns out a Sharpie, or in this case, an edding, as we call them around here, will just work as a lithography tool. You can just scribble your pattern that you want with a Sharpie and then do the whole process, and then you end up with making features. This is a test pattern that has been liftoff processed with an edding. I think it's an edding 300. And this has allowed us to selectively deposit chrome on silicon. This is not a functional part. It just looks really stupid, and I love it. Okay, we have to get a bit serious. Like, this is a breakthrough. This is a 1.5 centimeter feature size at FAFO. And now that I think of it, like, a while back, like, we've been making progress. Like, this is the previous feature size we had. This is 2 meters. And I'm just going to, like, plot this. And I think next year we're going to get 10 nanometers. Like, if you want to invest in the FAFO, you can't. It's a non-profit. But if you want to give us money, you know, you can just do it. But okay, calm down. I don't have a startup. Where were we? Oh, yeah. Mr. President, a second evaporator has hit the FAFO. This is our second evaporator, because I lied to you. Well, I didn't lie to you. I told you there's more than one evaporator. This is the second one. This is our Edwards Auto 306. It's a front-loading evaporator. All good washing machines are front-loading. And this one is actually 80s technology. It's electronically controlled, and it has a turbo pump. So we're getting to like modern stuff. Inside of it, it's still like, you know, British engineering. It's fine, I guess. But the cool thing is that it has e-beam evaporation as well. The cool thing about e-beam is that you can selectively heat up a sample without warming the whole thing up. And it can even do things that are not metallic. Like, you can actually use an electron beam to selectively heat up a source of SiO2, so glass, and that will also evaporate and coat whatever is in the chamber. I have not seen people DIY an electron beam evaporator setup. I don't think there's anything stopping you from doing that. Like, I don't see why no one has done that, or maybe I just haven't found it on YouTube. And also, because you have an e-beam evaporator, you can make funny jokes by removing the second leg of the M, third leg of the M, and then it becomes beans, and that's actually quite hilarious if you have the brainworms we do. So, e-beam safety. This is an electron beam. You're going to need a few kilovolts to bring this up. Don't fuck with this. Like, please be careful. You know, check if the feed-throughs are safe. Check if they're not, like, shorting out. Triple measure your grounding. Check the docs, what they say. Like, this is all should be in the manual. Just, yeah, treat this with the seriousness it deserves, even in a hack lab. Two fun facts about this power supply that you see here. First of all, it's based on valves. It's really, really old technology, but it works really well. So if you turn it on, you actually see the glow of valves from the back fan ports. That's kind of cool. Second thing, those phase indicators, L1, L2, R3, they're just broken. Like, all three broke. And so do not trust indicators. Like, just because the thing says there is no phase doesn't mean there isn't one. So yeah, here's another video. If it starts playing, hello. This is FAFO ambience. that I've tried to capture, and you see me working the EVM evaporator setup, you more or less kind of see what the process looks like. It's a lot of twisting knobs, looking for feedback from instruments, looking at the sample getting coded up there. You can kind of see a sample holder up there. You can hear some music in the background because FAFO is never silent. And I'm going to try to look inside the chamber and show the source as well. But it's very difficult to film, so I have a photo on the left as a comparison of how it looks like when you actually care to take a good photo. And yeah, it's just standing in front of a machine and you do the thing until it does the thing. There's like three indicators you have to follow. Sometimes the machine just shuts off because you've broken one of the invariants. You learn to do this. So, and this is the automatic system. Like, this is the one where you're supposed to like be able to just press a button and it goes. And it's, maybe we'll get to that point someday, but it's not that point yet. Sample holding, you might have seen that. Rahix and Laura designed this. This is super cool. This allows us to hold all the samples we possibly want. This didn't come with a sample holder. If you're wondering, can I 3D print this? Yeah, I mean, it melts a bit. But you can. But I highly recommend getting someone who knows how to machine things and just making it for you. Yeah, that's it about thermal evaporation.
So we saw the problems of thermal evaporation in the last slide. So stuff gets hot. That's like the main problem. And also, the line of sight depositing was pretty good, but sometimes you have like steps or pits in your structure, and then you get uneven deposition with line of sight. So maybe we should look into other techniques as well. And yes, stuff gets hot, and also stuff in the chamber can react easily because there's lots of energy there. And like, if you, for example, it can happen that metal melts into the boat which you are heating, and then you have some alloys that you don't want in your process or something. Also, the deposition rate is pretty high, which is often a feature, but sometimes you want to make very thin layers, and then you cannot really control this. So the other technique that I mentioned is called sputtering, and I will show the easiest version to do it, which is called direct current sputtering. So again, we have a vacuum chamber, and first we create a vacuum. And into the vacuum, we slowly add argon gas. Argon is a noble gas, so it's not reacting with anything inside the chamber else. But since it's a vacuum and we now put on some direct current between this anode and the cathode of this construction, we actually are starting to generate a plasma. So if you don't know what a plasma is, it's essentially another state that a material can have. And in this plasma state, the electrons are delocated. So actually, in this what looks like a cloud here, we don't just have argon atoms, but we have argon ions, and we also have the electrons, which I have not drawn here. And now what happens is that the positively charged argon ions are attracted to the cathode, so they will shoot into the cathode, and the cathode contains our aluminum thing again. And now in the case of sputtering, it's called the sputtering target, which is a bit confusing because it's not the thing that you want to deposit on, but it's the thing where the ions flow into. And so this happens with such a great force that other atoms of the aluminum are being kicked out because the charged ion hit the surface. And so an aluminum atom will be kicked out, and again, since it's a vacuum, it will go into the direction of the sample and deposit on the sample. And in practice, we want also to use a magnetron to control where this plasma exactly is, because that just makes it easier to work on this. And yeah, so what actually happens is that we are destroying the cathode and depositing, like we are destroying the surface of the cathode and are depositing again the target on the sample. And so this is why in Germany it's called Kathodenzerstäubung, because the cathode is being turned into dust. And there are some applications of this that we already did at Fafo. So on the right, you see the picture of human hair. And in a scanning electron microscope, you can only look at things that are conducting, and a hair is not conducting. So we put it into the sputter coater to create a thin layer of chrome, I think, in this case. And so this allows you to get this picture, which has, I mean, you can see the structure of the hair. You can also see the sputtering is not so greatly even as it should be, maybe. But the process works in principle. And because we have this whole plasma cloud and we have a much larger target, we get atoms from all kinds of directions compared to the straight line things. So it's easier to coat also these uneven surfaces here. So it's a standard technique for SM preparation. And in industry, sputtering is also used. For example, it's used to make the platters of hard drives, which you would not want to heat up very much because they would lose their magnetic conditions. And also, like the shiny stuff on the CD-ROM is also sputtered on, actually. Same thing for the thin film transistors in the LCD display, for example. So there are some tricks that you can do with sputtering. If you change the direction of the power, then you are kind of Anodenzerstäubung, which means that you are like destroying the surface of the substrate, and this can be used to clean the substrate. Like if you are not sure it has an even surface or a surface which stuff can deposit on easily, you can just do this kind of sputter etching. Also, sometimes you want to deposit non-conducting materials, and then there's a technique called HF sputtering or RF sputtering, where you use a high frequency or radio frequency source by using a high frequency alternating current. And a third thing that's sometimes used is called reactive sputtering. So you do not only add argon, but for example, also very controlled portions of oxygen or something, then you can create oxides or nitrides if you add nitrogen. And on the right, you see we found a dead fly at Fafo, and Rahix had to sputter it. And so you see the very, very small hairs that a fly apparently has that we didn't know about. So yes, this is an example of sputtering. So
it's me again. There's a third machine. You can see it's another Auto 306 we have at Fafo, and this one is equipped for sputtering. It has two sputtering heads, one for the direct current stuff, one for the RF slash frequency stuff. And really, the main difference between that and the other machine is it has also a way to, other than the heads, is it has a way to inject gases. It does this via two mass flow controllers, allowing you technically two different gases. Before we get into that, some safety notes. If you're going to do RF sputtering, I'm not going to say don't, but like be really, really careful. Like that stuff can and will kill you, and it will hurt all the way. Please look into safety protocols. Like have interlocks. This is like the scariest part for me for doing any of this is the RF sputtering part. We just stick to DC because I kind of prefer being killed by high voltage DC than high power RF. I know it's just a personal choice. Another safety note, Leia found this while researching for this talk. Let me just quote from Mattox, Handbook of Physical Vapor Deposition Processes. There have been several explosions in plasma pumping systems when people try to pump pure oxygen for a system containing hydrocarbon pump oils. Compressing pure oxygen in contact with the hydrocarbon oil is like making a diesel engine. And I quote, vacuum pumps are not designed to be internal combustion engines. So yeah, don't do that. Let's go back to our diagram. This is where we kind of left off, but we're going to rip out everything from the inside and kind of replace it with a sputtering system. So we're going to have like a sputter head that's going to be supplied with your DC of RF. You're going to have your sputter target, which is what you're depositing. And you're going to form a plasma cloud above it. This is like, you probably know, like designing a sputter head, this is an art. These are magnetrons. This is like weird plasma physics stuff. Thankfully, we just got it from Kleinanzeigen. And you also need two mass flow, like you need the mass flow controller to like slowly inject whatever process gas you want, because you want like a stable level of that, in this case argon, to perform, to strike your plasma and then to continue using it. Speaking of gases, gas safety, don't asphyxiate yourself. This is not more difficult than dealing with argon in like welding situations, so follow instructions there, just kind of do the math in like worst case scenario, how fucked are you? And I'm only talking about inert stuff, like where I'm not getting into oxygen or God forbid stuff for reactive ion etching. This is just like for the inert stuff. Still, please be careful. Gas injection. We use mass flow controllers. You can technically use a leak valve, but it's nicer to be able to do this automatically. The mass flow controllers are basically fancy servo valves where it is able to tell how much mass flow, so how much actual gas is flowing in regardless of the pressure that it's at, and is able to adjust its setting so that it follows, setting so that it follows a given set point. This is also eBay junk. You'll see them rated for a given number of standard cubic centimeters per minute, and for a given gas, just find something that matches your process. Like 100 standard cubic centimeters for argon is more or less what you're looking for. Maybe 50 will be fine as well. We got MFCs with the setup. We also got this big MFC controller. Like this is a PC plus some rack mount equipment plus a screen plus stuff. We don't want that. Let's just make our own. Or we can just use lab equipment. You can see this is a setup where we're controlling the plasma using just a lab power supply to set an analog voltage on the mass flow controller and then a multimeter to read out the current state. You also need to give it some power supply, like plus minus 15 volts. But that's ugly. How do we automate this? Well, we could just use an Arduino, but can we make it more complicated? Yes, we can. Welcome, Modbus. If you want to do it, if you want to overdo it, why not overdo it in an industrial fashion? This is a protocol that you can use to control sensors and actuators over a network, RS-485 for UDP. The cool thing is that you can put this like somewhere close to your machine and then run a big RS-485 bus around your lab and control all of that from like normal Linux machines. It kind of feels more robust than dealing with microcontrollers for me, mostly because I have, even with like this cheap import stuff, like I have a vague idea that this stuff's not going to die on me and that I don't have like design an ADC and a DAC. It's kind of nice in a way. Again, it's just Linux stuff, so in our case, we wrote some Rust code to talk to the actuators that then control the MFC. The technologies are pretty modern. I'm actually quite happy with this. You can see my shitty Rust code here on the side. And on the client side, we also wrote a front end because this is an HMI, effectively, a human-machine interface. I used the only correct way to do this, which is something that looks like a Windows 98 interface with Windows with 98.css. And just so you know, this is not a boneless demo. This is it being used right now to strike a plasma. Bonk. So this is a real system that allows us to control the plasma in a pretty nice fashion. So yeah, congratulations. Have unlocked the technology of sputter coating. It's a bit of a step up from thermal evaporation. Like you need that gas, you need the sputter head, but people still manage to do that on YouTube. So what do you do now? You can sputter coat yourself a little cathode of Saddam Hussein and then have it very shiny. If you want something less practical, here's a sputter-coated, I think this was a Band-Aid, so you can see the different parts of the Band-Aid now under the SEM. As we've shown, this is for being able to even see samples under a SEM that are not usually conductive. And then you can also kind of check your own processes. In this case, this was, I think, done with thermal evaporation, and then I sputter-coated it so that I actually put this under the SEM because the main bulk substrate was silicon, and I wanted it to be more conductive than that. Still not serious enough? All right, let's actually try to do something nice. So if you can deposit aluminum and some kind of insulator, you can make a capacitor. It's really not rocket surgery. You can control and use the liftoff process to like selectively make different rectangles on top of each other and stack up something that is a parallel plate capacitor. You can find the formula to calculate it. I think for the one that I made here, it was supposed to have 35 nanofarads. And the aluminum foil was just aluminum foil. Sorry, the aluminum was just aluminum foil from Rewe. Like you just take up a spool of foil, crunch it up, put it in your e-beam evaporator or thermal evaporator, and that's the kind of quality that you can use for actually making some simple stuff. So this is 100 nanometers, 500 nanometers, 100 nanometers. Again, did the math. It was supposed to be 35 nanofarads. It was closer to 80, so something's obviously wrong. There's a few options. Either our film thickness monitor is way off. Maybe the dielectric is not pure SiO2. Like I know there's some reactions going on between the oxygen of the SiO2 and the underlying aluminum layer, so maybe that's what's happening. But we did make a capacitor, so like again, this is obviously that it should work if you have all this technology with you. However, the measurement kind of hints at this, you know, still needing a bit further work. The more exciting part is like if you can deposit aluminium on doped silicon. If you can get your hands on doped silicon wafers, which you can if you have an eBay.com account, or just ask us, we have a ton of this now, you can just make a Schottky diode, because for magical reasons of work functions and band theory and stuff, if you deposit aluminium on n-doped silicon, you get a Schottky barrier. You just have to make sure that aluminium is actually well deposited on the silicon, not going through an oxide layer, not reacting with the silicon as it's getting deposited, hence the thin film techniques and PVD in the first place. Not because we don't have access to HF, but because I want you to be able to replicate this, you don't even have to use HF. You can just use sandpaper to remove any oxide layer that might be on the silicon wafer you got from eBay.com. And then you just chuck it in the machine covered with aluminium, and looks like a diode to me, like that IV curve. You have the units here, even does definitely look like an IV curve. The problem is that if you look at it, pick up it a bit closer, like the actual metal of the probes here and the silicon and the aluminium that's effectively acting as a p-doped material in this case also creates a Schottky barrier. So it's not exactly clear where in that setup the Schottky diode is, but it is there somewhere, like we have measured it. This also needs further work. I think congratulations, you have survived this. It took us 50 minutes as mm-hmm. planned. I would like to thank everyone that helped make this happen. I would like to thank everyone who's a member of FAFO, who's one of our associates, who visits us regularly. I'd like to also help Giga Becker and Stud Logic Vector from the Munich Fab Lab from helping us bring up the first thermal evaporator as well. I would like to thank LDCD from the internet for also being helpful with a lot of this stuff. I also like to thank Eric from Attractor in Hamburg for helping us also understand a lot of this stuff early on in the process. And finally, I would like to thank Laura for contributing her machining skills to the holding plate for the samples you've seen before. I'm not sure we have time for questions, but if we do, that would be the time now. Otherwise, thank you.
Thank you.
See one hand. Do we have time, first of all? I think we have 1 or 2 minutes, right? Yeah, so we have like 8 hours. First of all, how to turn on my mic?
So two questions. One, is it likely that you're now on some kind of watch list? And second, I've heard that FAFA actually stands for fuck around and find out. So is this true?
Wow, way to blow our cover. First of all, I hope this talk outlined to the any person that might have us on the watch list that not only we are not a math lab, we also wouldn't be capable of being a math lab. I'm not aware if we're on any watch list. I haven't seen those watch lists. And if I saw, I would just ignore it. And second of all, I have no idea what you're talking about. I've never heard what fuck around find out means. That's just you coming up with that. I'm sorry. No, it's Fachverein für Forschung. Next question.
Hi, thanks. It was a very cool talk. Do you also plan to make a small transistor at some point?
Yes.
Ah, very cool. Thanks.
Yes, we have the tech tree, and that tech tree is like showing the current blockers. It is mostly on the ability to etch things safely. Like, we are trying to be very safe with what we do, contrary to what it might look like. So there's quite a bit of work we have to do before we're comfortable handling any of these materials required to actually do selective etching and also any lithographical processes, which might also depend on noxious chemicals.
Thanks.
So for the capacitor, you used a store-bought aluminium, right? Which is probably not very pure and will have a lot of other trace metals. Do you think that just that didn't matter for like this specific application? And what will you do if you need cleaner aluminium?
So we can just use like 99.99% pure aluminium that we have somewhere in a drawer, but that's no fun. I think actually like aluminium foil, I don't know about the purity of the material, but like the thickness definitely is like surprisingly repeatable. So I have a kind of vague idea that maybe the purity is also not that bad. Like, I don't understand how you would make this not pure in a production environment. Like, it's you take aluminium and you turn it into foil, right? Like,
doesn't yeah, seem I think like there could be a coating or something, but it's probably not another metal in
and
there.
And for the capacitor, That shouldn't affect anything because it's like the metal thickness and the metal composition doesn't really matter. It's really the dielectric between the two layers and the distance and the surface area that matters. It might, of course, mean different internal resistivity, but we didn't even measure that. You can do it.
Could you create doped surfaces by using the pure material and a little spot of the dopant next to it? Because I would assume that it would kind of mix in the air.
Yes, this is how you diffuse dopants into substrates. One of the ways. It's usually done in a vacuum furnace, or it's just a furnace, where you somehow create an atmosphere containing your dopant, and then you expose whatever regions you want to dope, and then that diffuses into the substrate. Sometimes it's done by like having pellets next to the substrate. Sometimes it's done by using like spin-on dopant, but basically this is how you selectively dope things, I think, even to this day. No, you use ion implantation. Today in industry, you use ion implantation, which is a more complex technique, but in the 70s, 80s, you used exactly that. You just diffused things by having like a bit of the boron or a bit of the phosphorus in the atmosphere when you were heating it up. But this is not in a deposition setup, it's in a furnace setup.
I see. Thank you.
So one question here, the next one should be there again, and then we keep going like that, right?
So, from a machining background, I know that some tools have, I think, titanium nitride coatings. Would that be doable in a sputter coater, and what do I need to bribe you?
It's titanium and what?
Nitride, I think.
Oh, TIN. Yes, that is true. There's like the little, it's like the golden thing, right?
Or
is
it?
Yeah. Actually, I don't know what should be stopping us from doing that. Like, I don't know how easy it is to sputter tin. Do you know, Leah? We haven't tried that. The only thing that's stopping up is that we haven't tried it yet.
Yeah.
Okay.
But I think sputtering is used for these kind of coatings.
Oh, and to bribe me, like if where is it? You don't need to bribe me. You just need to invest. Just become a FAFO investor. As in, give us your money and we give you nothing in return.
No, you get a donation received in return. So,
become a FAFO investor. I think that might be it. Any other last minute questions? If not, then we would like to thank you once more.
Yes,
and I'll see you next year.